Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence recently released some troubling data. It shows an upward tick in homicides related to domestic violence. Between 2018 and 2023, on average, there was a domestic violence-related homicide every 4 days in North Carolina, an increase of nearly 70%. Last year, there were 92 domestic violence homicides, 19 more than the previous year, and 39 more than in 2018. And this year, in just the first 3 months, there have been 9 domestic violence-related homicides, including 4 in the Charlotte area. This type of violence isn't happening in just one part of town. It's happening all over, affecting all communities, all demographics. The surge has prompted a renewed focus, not just on the victims, but on understanding why this is happening, what drives it, how to prevent it. And we explore that this hour with Molly McCambridge, Director of Prevention and Abuse Intervention at the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Bea Cote is also with us. She is founder and executive director of Impact Plus Abuse Prevention Services. And Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV who has covered numerous stories involving domestic violence in his time at Channel 9. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Molly, let me start with you. The numbers have been rising year after year. We did a program on, I went back and looked. We did a program on this topic in 2018, which was the baseline for that 70% increase that I referenced a moment ago. Back then, 25% of the homicides that Charlotte experienced in the previous year were related to domestic violence, and CMPD was responding to about 100 domestic violence calls a day. Mm-hmm. Have things improved? Are they the same? Have they gotten worse?
Well, we definitely know that COVID-19 had a huge impact on rates of domestic violence. A lot of times, you know, at the very beginning, people were in their homes and not able to leave as often. And there have been increases in domestic violence rates since then. We've seen since 2018, we did a survey with all of our member organizations around the state, all of the domestic violence service providers. And the DV services are 51% higher than they were in 2018. So we're seeing a lot more people seeking services since then, which shows us that the rates are rising, certainly. And already they were quite high. You know, about 1 in 3 people will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And we're only seeing more people seeking services. And COVID-19 had a huge impact on that.
Of course, a lot of the people who are involved in domestic violence are not seeking services. They're suffering silently or perpetrating as quietly as possible, at least outside of the home. Hunter, how many do you know? How many calls for domestic violence incidences that CMPD is responding to these days on an average day?
On an average day, I'm not sure. I will say there are thousands a year. And the reason I say that is because also Safe Alliance gets thousands of calls a year from victims who are needing help. And those, like you mentioned, are only the victims who are calling for help. Many of them don't decide to call for help, Mike. Mm.
Molly, your organization defines domestic violence-related homicide as, quote, victims killed by their current or former intimate partner, as well as third parties killed because of intimate partner violence. And just as the number of incidents has been rising, the number of clients that you serve, as you'd mentioned, is also on the rise. Is most of the domestic violence that leads to death, the death of the victim, the result of the use of firearms?
I'm not sure how many homicides are as a result of a firearm, but I do know that the presence of a firearm in a DV situation increases the risk of homicide by 5 times, 500%. And another major factor that increases the risk of domestic violence is when strangulation occurs. In 2009, I think, there was a study that showed that when strangulation occurs in a DV situation, there's a 6 times higher risk of attempted suicide or attempted homicide, and a 7 times higher risk of completed homicide. So that's another huge factor. And in terms of firearms, the response that we're looking to see at the coalition is absolutely, common sense gun laws to be put in place to help mitigate some of that risk.
Actually, the figure that I have is that firearms were involved in about 75% of domestic violence cases between 2021 and 2023. I was going to talk about strangulation a little bit later in the program, but since you brought it up, you actually explained something I was going to ask about because I had two different figures for the statistics surrounding strangulation. And by strangulation, we don't mean that you've choked somebody to death. It just means that you've attempted to, or you have put your hands around their neck and tried to strangle them, but they survive. But as you point out, one statistic indicates that victims who have been strangled by their domestic partner in the past, I have these numbers, 750 times more likely to be killed by their partner in the future. Another study pegs that number at a 600% greater likelihood of being killed. And yet, Hunter, the punishment for strangulation is one that Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather feels does not fit the crime. He feels the punishment is too lenient. What is the punishment?
Yeah, so right now, the punishment, if you are convicted, you could technically get the same amount of probation as somebody who simply breaks into a tool shed. I've had multiple conversations with Spencer Merriweather about this because of the severity of what it could eventually lead to. And Mike, just to put it in a little bit of context or perspective, perhaps, I sometimes think a case may help some of your listeners just kind of portray this. There was a guy by the name of Wesley Smith who, in 2024, he's actually been convicted, so we can say he strangled his then girlfriend at an apartment complex, beat her in the bathtub. It was very, very awful things that he did. She survived, and somehow she found the courageous strength to testify in the case in the trial, and he ended up being convicted. He will face, I believe he was sentenced to up to 7 years in prison for it. There is a bill, though, that could change things, and that may be where you're headed, Mike.
Well, kind of, but you go ahead. I know that Spencer Merriweather at Mecklenburg County's DA is kind of leading the charge on something called House Bill 109, which is working its way through the General Assembly. What would it do?
Yeah, so this would make strangulation a mid-level felony, which would then increase the punishment from probation to up to 47 months in prison. And it also, this is crucial here, according to Spencer Merriweather, is that it would not require you to have proof of physical injuries at the time of the incident. You have to think, if you're strangling somebody, those wounds, those bruises may not appear for days after. Well, right now, you have to have physical proof to press those charges, either as the law enforcement who is investigating this. So a lot of times that strangulation charge was never really a factor because the victim didn't have the actual physical injuries at the time.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I was unaware that if you attempt to strangle somebody, that the marks, the bruises, whatever they may be, don't appear for several days in many cases. What if they don't appear? What if this law passes, you're allowed to charge somebody or accuse somebody of strangulation and the person is charged for it, but the bruises never appear?
That would probably be something that either the DA's office would have to consider, because, as we know, if they don't have the proof, they're likely not going to go forward with the case, because they probably can't get a conviction. You have to have, of course, the unanimous verdict at a trial if it were to go there. So my guess would be that would be a conversation with both investigators and the DA on what they could press if those physical injuries end up not appearing.
Bikote is with her. She's the founder and executive director of Impact Plus Abuse Prevention Services. What? Go ahead, B.
On the topic of strangulation, a lot of times victims may not even be aware that they have been strangled, and often use the language choking if they do call it anything at all. But the reason I point that out is because they may not be aware that they passed out. So if somebody says, "Did you pass out?" You know, as, and they're looking at that as a sign that there's been strangulation. What if she just passed out for 2 seconds and then came to in the same incident? How's she going to know she passed out if everything's the same when she comes to?
You work, B, with people in several counties, Mecklenburg, Union, Gaston, Cleveland, Lincoln counties, I believe.
Correct.
And you with people who have committed acts of domestic violence. What should we know about those individuals?
First of all, I want to put it in perspective. Everything that we've talked about so far is criminal domestic violence, which is almost always physical assault. And so if the police just in Mecklenburg County respond to, let's say, 40,000 calls for service for domestic violence each year, but they only identify at the tail end, which is all that goes on reports, about 7 to 8%. Right. And so we are severely underestimating the amount of domestic violence that's occurring out there that is not criminal. And so how are these victims getting identified? How do they know where to get help and come forward for things like threats, verbal abuse, or what we call coercive control, which is really behind every kind of abuse? Is coercive control. But so even with the acts of criminal abuse, if we're seeing that huge number, then what does that mean for other kinds of domestic violence? And I think we do a service to the community by educating the community about that. So how do you put a woman on a billboard if she doesn't have black eyes? You know, how do we call attention to these other devastating kinds of domestic violence? And so we need to educate the community about that. Our program does help men and sometimes women if there's no other service available to them in my other counties. But we work with men who have been identified, but not necessarily criminalized acts of domestic violence. And so we also accept those who have not been arrested or in any case legally held accountable, so they can come on their own. And I get quite a few referrals from therapists.
I have about a minute left, B, and I don't think you answered my question, which is what should we know about those individuals? And maybe I'll broaden it out, because maybe these people who are not criminally involved in criminal conduct, but just civil conduct, don't recognize that behavior in themselves. So what should we Correct. Know about them?
Well, so most of them come to my program believing themselves to be the victims. If they were caught, it hurts. There were consequences. And there are consequences even if they're not arrested or charged with anything. But if somebody has said, "You need to get help," and they come into my program that way, all of them believe themselves to be victims of their actual victim because they've been hurt. They have been held accountable in some way. And it could be as simple as their wife had said she was leaving unless he got some help.
Sounds vaguely politically familiar. That's B. Cote, who's the founder and executive director of Impact Plus Abuse Prevention Services. She's here with Molly McCambridge, director of Prevention and Abuse Services with the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and Hunter Sines from WSOC-TV. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. www.listenerfunded.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about domestic violence and domestic violence and abuse prevention with Molly McCambridge for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, B. Cote with Impact Plus Abuse Prevention Services, and Hunter Sines, who covers these incidents regularly in his role as a reporter for WSOC-TV. 6 years ago, Molly, in 2018, the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, of which I guess the North Carolina Coalition is a chapter, was working on policy approaches to, quote, create a society in which domestic violence is never tolerated nor minimized, in which victims and survivors are respected, and in which service providers have the resources to serve all victims and survivors. That was 6 years ago. Has progress been made on that front?
That's a hard question to answer. I think in some ways, yes. And in some ways, we face similar and more significant challenges now. I'd say where there are successes is, I'll stick to North Carolina, since that's my expertise. We have been seeing our programs, either for survivor services, domestic violence intervention services that are with offenders of domestic violence, and our policy advocacy, continue to work forward. We've had some small wins over this time. And I think something that I really want to highlight, and it speaks to what Bea had started to say about, you know, sometimes it can be challenging for survivors to name that they have experienced domestic violence. It's hard to know sometimes because it's so normalized. And in that same way, it can be hard, as you were saying, Mike, that somebody perpetrating domestic violence can name that they are using abusive behaviors, because these behaviors, especially the emotional and verbal abuse behaviors, are so normalized. And for other kind of reasons, it's, violence is enabled in our society in a lot of different ways, and it's excused and normalized. Yes, normalized, absolutely. And I think one way that we need to work towards, and have been working towards, preventing violence from happening is creating conditions in our society where violence is less normalized, less accepted, more challenged. And that can be all the way from an individual level, like in a group that B is leading, or it can be all the way at a societal level. Creating conditions where violence is less likely to happen is how we prevent violence from happening. Things like paid parental leave. You wouldn't think that that necessarily prevents violence, but it creates supports for people that minimize a risk that violence will occur in their home. It protects an economic security and stability that ends up making it more likely that people will experience less likely that a person will experience violence or perpetrate violence too. So I think in those ways we've had some wins, and that we continue to kind of work towards those things at all levels of society.
You've been working with perpetrators of domestic violence for quite a while. Before you started your own organization, you were a social worker. Managing a program for abusers. How does the work you did then as a social worker differ from what you're doing now with Impact Plus?
I believe that we've actually, in some regards, gone backwards. Not in the way we address domestic violence once they get to our program, but as an example, we used to have a really great coalition here in Charlotte of all providers of domestic violence services. And I think the pandemic did away with a lot of those coalitions' efforts to include everybody. Anytime there's a discussion about domestic violence, those who work with the abusers need to be at the table. And that's not happening anymore. I think we did away with a lot of the work that was being done. And that's because of the pandemic. And also, as a result of the pandemic, the courts really struggled. And so my numbers went way down too, because the courts were just not able to handle the number of cases that came into them. And so they were having to drop a lot of the cases, and that gives permission, I think, to the community and tells them that abuse is okay. If you don't get in trouble for it,
for very good
reasons, it's okay.
For very good reasons, a lot of the focus traditionally has been on the victims and the survivors of domestic violence, because they're the ones who have been hurt by this, Molly. But you say,
yes,
and this kind of backs up what Bea just said, you say that there is less research and fewer resources being dedicated to the offender side of this equation. If that were not the case, how would that equation be different?
That's absolutely true. There's something around 90 domestic violence service providers that serve survivors in North Carolina, and there's currently 34 domestic violence intervention programs. There's this huge stark difference, and part of that is because of funding. Service providers for survivors are funded by the federal government, and not enough ever. Domestic violence intervention programs that serve offenders run on participant fees. Participants have to pay for this service. They're not free like the survivor services are. And that's how they stay open, and it's already too few resources. So an investment from the federal government and state governments in these programs would be a huge change that would help to serve more people offending domestic violence towards accountability and preventing violence ultimately.
Which we will talk about in a second here. B, the idea that all the money goes to victims as opposed to offenders is a problem in your mind, because I know that you have a slogan, and it's only abusers can stop abuse. If that's
correct.
The case, more dollars need to go to people who work with the abusers, correct?
Correct. And that's why I have a nonprofit now. And my nonprofit is able to offer sliding scale fees in order to kind of stop the victims from having to continue to pay for their own abuser's treatment. About half the time, the abusers are still with the victims that they've abused. Now, that may drop off as they go along in the program, but we don't realize that a lot of these guys are still with their victims, and we're trying to provide services. And if he's abused her, especially economically, which is one of the favorite types of abuse used by our wealthier abusers. And so, but what if they say to her, you know what, you got me in this mess, you have to pay for this. And so by offering a sliding scale, we hope to kind of reduce the number of our offenders who will do that kind of thing.
Hunter, you have the unfortunate job of covering some of these incidents, not all, but some of them do make the media. Not all of these incidents result in death. But I'm curious, what is the most common form these incidents seem to take in our area?
And are you asking in regards
to abuse? Yeah.
A lot of them, I mean, in warrants, I don't really ever use this, but it'll start as an argument, and it escalates in a physical nature. Oftentimes, to what B was saying earlier, is sometimes there's no physical abuse whatsoever. It's communicating threats. It's showing up at a victim's house and threatening them in front of their kids, perhaps, and they are charged with that. I will say, usually, it only really meets me stepping in and sharing a story if there is a pattern of accused violence before we would hit the threshold of sharing that story. And quite frankly, there are a lot of things that go into our discussion of why do we cover it. One of those is we definitely don't want to re-victimize the victim in these things. We don't want to put that person in a worse area. For instance, when they are communicating threats or only charged with something that's not physical, they're going to be out on bond likely in 24 hours. And if we step in and cover that, is that putting that woman or that man in harm's way all over again? So it's a very touchy thing to cover, Mike. And oftentimes it does only get the coverage, sadly, when it is very bad, or there is a homicide, or it leads to something fell into the crack and we need to shine a light on how we can fix it. But I rather be very cautious in leading up to it than just posting and covering every single domestic violence. I think when we talked about even in doing this show, I mean, over the weekend, there have been multiple arrests on domestic violence charges here in Mecklenburg County alone. But oftentimes, to your original question, I see a majority is physical. It's they attacked the person. They strangled the person without those charges. But often there are also the other side where it's no physicality at all. It's showing up at their workplace and they feel threatened.
Yeah, I want to come back. I want to come back and talk about how the media handles some of this, because the media gets a lot of heat for just doing their job, and sometimes we do it well, and sometimes we make mistakes. But when you're covering incidences like this, it seems that you're walking a really tight wire that may be loose and sloppy for you to negotiate. I want to come back and talk about that. But for years. And this is probably prior to your becoming a reporter, Hunter, because it was years ago. Police, law enforcement, would come to these, respond to these incidences, and they would treat them like what they are. These are family disputes. We're going to stay out of this. We're going to cool the situation. We're going to close the door and go away. Has that changed? From your experience of covering these stories, how do police consider these incidents? What is their reaction to them? What do they do?
So there has been, of course, more training that I can speak to that CMPD. I usually cover CMPD a majority of my day that they have acquired over the past few years. Yes, you're probably right in that timeline that was before my time, at least here in Charlotte. But when they approach a domestic violence, it is often heated. Neighbors sometimes are involved in trying to just separate the two. Sometimes if it's in their actual bedroom, it can be one of the most dangerous calls that CMPD gets to actually enter. We've seen it turn into officer-involved shooting sometimes, Mike, as you know. But oftentimes they like to separate the parties. They will talk to each one. They usually look for physical injuries on one before making a decision to arrest. But I will tell you, from what I have covered, it seems like law enforcement has taken domestic violence a bit more serious when it comes to physical and criminal charges, and actually going away from the scene and arresting someone and at least charging them with a misdemeanor, if not an actual assault charge.
And B, when police and or the courts step in, that doesn't necessarily break the cycle, doesn't necessarily end it, does it?
No, absolutely not. What it does, though, is if we were to hold these guys for a while in jail, which is not happening anymore, then it would give the victim time to get out of the emergency room and perhaps, you know, get away, pack a bag to get away. But as it is right now, these guys are bonding out or not even being set a bond and are going straight home after being arrested. And oftentimes they'll beat the victim home. And the cycle continues that way. And so the arrest may disrupt the abuse for a while, but he may also blame her. So it could escalate the abuse. One thing that I do want to point out that escalates the abuse is separation, if she leaves him, if he thinks that she's leaving him, or if she's left him and won't come back or moved on, those are all really, really huge red flags for victims, because most murders, the statistics say 75 to 78%, but I guarantee you that it's more than 90% of the domestic violence murders happen because she had the nerve to leave him.
Molly, because we have new approaches by law enforcement, they do take this very seriously now, as opposed to when they used to just say, well, it's a domestic incident, we're staying out of it. And we now have support groups, and people do talk openly about this now. It's no longer something that's necessarily hidden in the shadows, and although there probably still is some stigma attached to both parties from this, which maybe leads them to be relatively quiet about it, it's out in the open. It's not something we hide from anymore. But the incidents continue to rise. Do we understand why?
Well, you know, domestic violence is a very complex problem. All violence is. Domestic violence is particularly complicated in some ways, or like uniquely complicated of a problem, both at the interpersonal level, like between two people, and as a social problem. And it's going to take it a very complex solution to address it, a nuanced solution that involves many different sectors, many different players, and the collaboration between those people, the coalition, domestic violence intervention programs, law enforcement, the courts, victim services, teachers, healthcare providers, workplaces, you know, this is, we need to really, legislators, we really need to be together in the solution. But it's completely achievable with the right training and resources. I think it's certainly changed a little bit, or you know, maybe a lot. It's certainly changed in terms of the privacy of domestic violence, the stigma that it's a personal issue, it's a family issue, and we don't talk about it. And there still is a lot of residual shame and culture around that. It still certainly exists. And I want to talk a little bit. I was a co-facilitator of a group similar to Bee's, a domestic violence intervention program in Durham, Orange, and Chatham County that worked with offenders. And I remember worked with hundreds of, you know, domestic violence offenders in that job and facilitated these groups that, you know, helped to address these abusive behaviors. And I remember one participant said, you know, I was in prison for this not that long ago, and this time I was sentenced to this group, and in prison I learned how I didn't want to be, and in this group I'm learning how I want to be. And that's a huge shift.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about domestic violence and ways to spot it, ways to treat it, ways to prevent it. Molly McCambridge works on that in her real life, not when she's a guest, but as Director of Prevention and Abuse Services at the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, as does Bee Cote, Founder and Executive Director of Impact Plus Abuse Prevention Services. And Hunter Sines is with us, who has the unfortunate responsibility of reporting on these incidences for WSOC-TV. There are a lot of factors that go into what makes a person domestically violent, Molly. We hear a lot today about toxic masculinity. We hear a lot today about young men and boys being lost because they don't know what their place in the world is, as the demography of the workplace and other aspects of their life have changed. We've noticed in the culture an increase in hate against women by some men, and misogynistic attitudes and remarks seeping out of the shadows. Several so-called influencers, social media influencers like Andrew Tate, who has 9.9 million followers on X, has called himself a misogynist, a quality that apparently others find attractive or admirable. So how big a factor is that to the root causes of what you're experiencing in the field today?
Well, it's a large factor, certainly. We think of it as kind of these harmful norms, social norms around masculinity and femininity, and the power dynamics between men and women in our society. And of course, men perpetrating domestic violence against women experiencing domestic violence is not the only domestic violence situation there is, although it's a very common situation. In fact, there's an 85% increase we see in North Carolina of the number of survivors identifying as LGBTQ from 2020 to 2023. So it's certainly not only an issue of misogyny, although that's toxic masculinity is part of what's addressed in domestic violence intervention groups. The kinds of learned attitudes and behaviors that are like, what is behind them? Where did we learn these attitudes and beliefs? And how do they result in certain types of abusive behaviors? That's a huge part of what's addressed in domestic violence intervention groups, because only then can you be accountable to those behaviors if you're understanding the attitudes and beliefs behind them. And there needs to be some type of internal motivation for that from an individual.
The other factors, as I understand it, include low self-esteem, low education, low income, younger people, younger ages who seem to exhibit this behavior, aggressive or delinquent behaviors when somebody was young are a good indicator that that may continue into their adulthood. Drug, alcohol abuse, depression, all of these are factors. Are there more?
I think that the biggest factor in all of them is poverty and oppression, racism. All of those things are things that when you put people in a box, they're going to try to get out however they can. Domestic violence is about power and control. Power is something that they already have, not that they're trying to get. It's a belief system. And control is a behavior as a result of that belief system. And so my abusers, almost all of them, abused because they were entitled to. Something told them that they had reason, just cause, or obligation even to discipline, correct, or otherwise abuse their victim. So it's really about entitlement. So when you look at power and entitlement, that's going to vary from group to group. So you may have a poor person who his only power may be physical. So he's going to use that physical power in order to abuse and control his partner. A man with wealth is going to use his wealth to economically abuse their partner. So domestic violence cuts across all socioeconomic and racial lines. However, we see an increase in criminal or physical domestic violence when there's also poverty and other kinds of oppression.
Molly.
I wanted to add on that. I think that's a really important topic because when we look to preventing violence or addressing violence and holding offenders accountable, the reason domestic violence exists is not, it doesn't come from within individual people alone. Certainly, the individual people are perpetrating violence. But what enables violence to happen is more than just warning signs from individual people from childhood. It's a social problem that's built on a number of factors. So we know from decades of research, partially funded by entities like the CDC, national entities are investing less and less now, but have invested for decades on data that shows that things that enable violence to happen, that increase the risk of violence happening, including domestic violence, are things like economic instability, poverty, a lack of parent-child connectedness, lack of a support system, lack of mental health resources, lack of policies and laws that support economic, educational, social equity, community connectedness and available services, all of these things that maybe we see the lack of, like a lack of safe and affordable housing and access to food and childcare, things that we see as maybe everyday life stressors are actually conditions that increase the risk that someone will perpetrate violence. So part of preventing violence is not just groups like BEES group, a domestic violence intervention program, that's teaching interpersonal and individual skills, but it's also addressing those more societal, community level conditions like healthcare, housing, education, all of those things. If we address and invest into those, we'll protect against violence happening.
Also, I want to add to that list, Molly, mental health and substance abuse services. Those are often co-occurring factors in domestic violence, but they're not causal factors. But what I wanted to bring up is I've seen an increase in family courts, in family law cases, in what we call post-separation abuse. So a lot of folks out there may be familiar with the power and control wheel. There's also a wheel that you can get by Googling called the post-separation abuse wheel. So here is what I'm seeing play out. When there's often been no physical abuse, so a victim doesn't know she's a victim, and then they separate or divorce, and then her abuser, who may never have been identified as an abuser before, now goes to court. And he goes after her for everything he can take from her, including her children. And we see that play out over and over again in family courts. The family court system is broken. A lot of these problems shouldn't even come up in divorce and custody actions, but they do. And I'm seeing women lose custody and rights even to their children by an abuser who has rallied, and oftentimes, if he's the one with the money, he's the one who can keep this in court. And so it's very devastating.
Men are generally I guess the largest make up the largest number of perpetrators, but women do it too. And it occurs, as we have said, in all communities, in all socioeconomic groups. There are hunter instances in the gay community of domestic violence. In those cases, I guess it's men on men or women on women. And I don't know if you can answer this question, but is law enforcement's response any different in those cases, or are they treated the same as straight couples who find themselves in that situation?
I'll answer it this way, Mike. Not that I've covered too many of those specific cases, but I will answer it in that oftentimes, if they are not treated the same, we usually will hear about it. And I have not heard of an accusation that it wasn't treated with the same severity as others. I'm sure that could differ in a lot of other communities. More rural communities, arguably, may see vastly different treatment when it comes to those types of relationships. But here in Charlotte specifically, I have not heard of them being treated differently than heterosexual relationships. But
One
Molly, I
way,
think.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Molly.
I would love to jump in there quickly.
Sure. Sorry.
Certainly, we've seen a big difference in our work in the way that LGBTQ people in a DV situation are, how law enforcement responds to their situations. A big factor, two large factors is that they are less likely to be believed. that domestic violence is occurring because of a bias and stigma. And another huge factor we see is an ineffective way to quote unquote determine who is using the abusive behaviors. Law enforcement, there's not enough kind of training and education around how to kind of, for lack of a better word, screen in the moment in real time who is experiencing domestic violence and who is perpetrating domestic violence in situations with LGBTQ couples.
One way I understand one way to prevent this is to teach people healthy relationship skills. And I know, B, that some of your programs go from 26 to 52 weekly sessions, which means a whole year, 6 months to a year for some of these individuals. And you intimately have been working with these folks for years now, different people, obviously, but you've been doing this job for years. What would you say your success rate is? And I guess the bottom line is, can a person change?
Yes, I could not do this work if I didn't believe that they can change. And I think that we are the best hope out there for change. What we do is provide them the tools that they need in order to be non-abusive. And the ones who actually use the tools, and they often use it outside of their relationship with their family members, with a grocery store clerk, in road rage, preventing road rage kind of situations. And so these folks who will use that information and absorb it and witness for themselves how much better their whole life changes. Their relationships with everybody can benefit and can change. And once they see that happening, they thirst for more of it. They want more and more of that positive feedback. They, start looking at how a relate bettering a relationship and making somebody safer also benefits themselves. But they have to get to that point where they see that. And in terms of recidivism, we have no way of really telling. There are some really good studies out there that show that our programs do work better than any other kind of programs that are out there. And so we are effective, but we can't follow him home and see what's happening in the home. We know that some who leave our programs discontinue with physical abuse, but may continue with the control.
Molly.
I just wanted to support what B's saying. I completely have the same experience in my time facilitating these groups. 26 weeks is sounds long, and I told this to the participants when on their first day, week, month. It sounds long, but it's just the beginning. It's a lifelong commitment to learning healthy behaviors and healthy relationship skills and accountability. Those are all practiced things. So absolutely, I've seen people change before my very eyes. And also it's uphill.
So I have about a minute and a half left, Hunter, and domestic violence, particularly when it involves injury or death, is a crime, and crimes are covered by the media, but these are crimes of mem among family members. So does the familial nature of these crimes change the way you or others who do your job, journalists, change the way you cover these stories? Does it cause you to leave out certain details because of privacy concerns? Or do you simply report the facts as you would in any other story as you uncover them?
We always lead with the facts, of course. And when it comes to these, especially, it's like not that we would in any other circumstance, but you definitely don't want to sensationalize these specific stories when it comes to DV issues. One thing that I always have is, especially if we are dealing with a survivor, I don't go to the survivor. I will call family, I will call friends, I will see if there is a family member who is a spokesperson for this whole case, because I don't want to personally re-victimize that person. I don't show where it happened specifically. I won't show the street. We won't show the home or the apartment. You're wanting to do everything you can to try to respect alleged victim in this case. The other thing is, yes, tragically, we will cover it if it really gets bad, but we try to stay out of it if it is a communicating threats or if it hasn't led to a huge physical violence.
So we spent this hour talking about domestic violence, and I want to mention that if you or someone you know is in a domestic violence situation, there is help available. There is a 24-hour domestic violence crisis hotline. That number is 980-771-HOPE. That's the Greater Charlotte Hope Line. Again, that's 980-771-HOPE. Or to get help for abusers, you can visit the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence website at nccadv.org/get-help. That's hard. There you can find a list of domestic violence intervention programs in North Carolina, also known as abuser treatment classes or batterer intervention programs. nccadv.org/get-help. Molly McCambridge from the North Carolina Coalition for Against Domestic Violence, B. Cote with Impact Plus Abuse and Prevention Services, and Hunter Sines from WSOC-TV. Thank you all.
Thanks. Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.